I think we're starting.
Check 1-2, check 1-2.
You're coming in loud and clear, 1-2-9-er, 4-5-er. Welcome, everybody. This is, if I have my numbers correctly, our fourth public assembly of the Independent Labor Club of New York City, and you've made it. This is a test today. I'm Sean, by the way, spokesperson for the ILC. This is a test to see if on the nicest day of the year thus far, on the day when spring has sprung, if we can get 50 or 100 people into a relatively windowless room to talk about tariffs. So far, so good. I think we've done pretty good so far. So we can all give ourselves a good, nice big pat on the back for that. We have a little feedback-ish, sort of. Bear with us, folks. I think we're all right. It sounds good? Thumbs up if it sounds good. Getting a lot of thumbs up here. For the people, we are recording this for podcast internet radio. So, you know, do understand, too, that this will be recorded for posterity. Your reactions will be recorded for posterity. So react well, my friends. Thank you so much again for coming to our panel. We have three excellent and esteemed guests. Today, we're going to be talking about Trump, tariffs, and the working class. Without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and we'll start with Cyrus. Introduce yourself. Give yourself a short little blurb or bio, and we'll come right on down the line.
Sure, I'm Cyrus Capo. I'm an adjunct professor at John Jay College. Teach macroeconomics there to undergraduates. That's also where I did my education. Happy to be part of the panel.
Happy to have someone from the City University of New York. Woo! On the panel today. Woo! Yeah, we can get some applause for that. Danny, go ahead.
My name is Danny Jacobs. I'm coming from Pennsylvania today, so I took a train, 2-hour train to be here. Very excited to be here. Thank you very much. And I'm representing both the Platypus Affiliated Society and Sublation, kind of both together. There you go.
Thank you.
Hello. All right, there we go. My name is Ryan Costello. I'm the chair of the Maoist Communist Union. We're a pre-party organization here in the United States. And I am also a co-host of the YouTube channel Marxism Today.
Yes. All right. Thank you. And once more, I'm Sean from the Independent Labor Club of New York and also the Antifada podcast. We can cheer for that. That's fine. Whatever. Much thanks to our esteemed guests. I think what we want to try to get our heads around today, and we want to get our heads around this with all of you, is what sort of changes can we anticipate coming down the pipe for ourselves and for members of our class, now that it seems like the entire neoliberal order, if you want to call it, is shifting, right? Maybe being sublated, right? Certainly not being abolished, because neoliberalism, it seems like maybe Trumpism is hyper-neoliberalism, maybe it's post-neoliberalism, maybe it's like pre-Fordist. That's what these questions are what we want to get at today, to kind of understand the terrain on which those of us who are invested in the left, invested in the working class, will be struggling on for the next 4 years. Not simply a big P politics question, but a social question as well, a labor question as well. These are the things we kind of want to tease out today. So thanks again to everybody for coming to the event. Without further ado, we'll do about 60 minutes here with the three of us. I know, Danny, you have some remarks prepared, which is awesome. And then we'll go across the panel and we'll ask some questions and do some back and forth. We'll do that for about 60 minutes and then we'll break. And then the ILC, in true mutual aid fashion, will be providing food and beverages for everybody. We'll do a little bit like a 30, 45 minute break, and then we'll do a town hall where we'll open things up into the round and everybody can discuss perhaps what is to be done, the big question, after we've kind of figured out where we're at right now. So again, let's start with Danny. Danny, go ahead and give us your prepared remarks on Trump, tariffs, and the U.S. working class.
So thank you very much again for the invite. Should we pick a side on the tariff question? No. Why? Do the workers have a dog in the fight? Certainly tariffs will hurt workers. Prices will rise. Volatility will discourage hiring. Maybe some workers will benefit from their business being protected, and maybe some others will be able to gain in the opportunities of companies choosing to invest in the U.S. to avoid tariffs. But the two parties want you to choose a side on the tariffs. Either you are going to make America great again, or America is going to give itself a stunning self-inflicted defeat. The question here is, what should an independent labor movement do? Is the tariff question just the ruling class bickering over the spoils of its share? Or is there some problem they are trying to solve, however obliquely?
Both. The old classical critique of tariffs predates Adam Smith, perhaps by over a century. Trade in the Middle Ages was so regulated that a wine trader, my favorite, might have to pay 100 tolls on their travel from Marseille to Paris. This was considered good. Wealth meant to not be the person who was working. But modern bourgeois society, the society of labor, urban society, made the old system irrational. To participate in the society required only one thing, that you were productive and you allowed others to do the same. People had been told that we were all children of God, but only labor made it the word in flesh. The idea of a tariff then was shot through as if it was a pagan auspice. Would you listen to the candlestick makers if they petitioned their governments to block out the sun? I wouldn't. Furthermore, the fetish of the trade balance was shown to be an illusion. Underneath it all was just the cooperation of all of our labor. To inhibit this, you know, your fellow person's labor, was not only to rob from, you know, your fellow person, but yourself. We were all in it together. So by the end of the 18th century, tariffs had returned, but they were kind of justified under peculiar conditions. Maybe tariffs were supposed to be educational for new industries.
For defenders of this new American system, the second most important July 4th was July 4th, 1789, when George Washington signed the Tariff Act for the encouragement and protection of manufacturers. It was considered the foundation of labor in America. And, you know, whereas Thomas Jefferson had believed that the U.S. could remain predominantly agriculture in the global system, Alexander Hamilton in 1791 would try to make some kind of case that you would need internal differentiation. You would need manufacturing, agriculture.
This is the guy from the musical.
Yeah. So when they were rap battling, one of them was like, we should be agriculture. And the guy's like, what about tariffs? Da, da, da. Okay, so while the tariffs did not cause the Industrial Revolution, they did accelerate it. By undermining the measure of social values, so I'm talking about labor here, the Industrial Revolution brought about the return of the old crap, kept it PG-13, but with a new content. So the free traders of the 19th century could not explain why there was a return of mercantilism, of tariffs then. They thought, hadn't we dealt with this like 200 years ago? But there was another thing in the 19th century that was new besides the monopolies and mercantilism, and that was the politically organized working class. Famously, the workers got involved in a struggle involving tariffs. This was called the Corn Laws in England. So this was the tariff on the importation of corn. But what mattered was how they got involved. For, you know, the kind of infamous Marx and Engels, if I can bring them up, the only thing that mattered was how the workers learned to kind of play the Whigs and Tories, the kind of two parties off of each other. Meaning the only thing that mattered is how it advanced their political independence. Could they start to think like workers? Otherwise, even the success of the reforms, so I'll talk about the Corn Laws, was, as they put it, adulterating the self-organization of the working class. So even when the Corn Laws were like abolished, workers still saw their wages fall anyways. So it went the opposite of what they were claiming for. So, quote, the question of free trade or production, would later write Frederick Engels, moves entirely within the bounds of the present system of capitalist production and has therefore no direct interest for us socialists who want to do away with the system. Tariffs, as Engels knew, were an indirect attempt to manage industrial production refracted through bourgeois property or labor. What we have here, then, in the modern age, is the old contradiction of forces and relations of production. But without an organized proletariat, an organized, politically organized working class, this contradiction today seems like a scholastic phenomena, which I think is how you kind of set it up. What the hell is a tariff? What is this thing? Or like a geopolitical dispute, right? It's like the people fighting and we're not involved in it. So, for example, there is a recent book in 2020 by this guy, Michael Pettis and Matthew Klein. They're kind of mainstream writers. And their view on the trade deficit was that the problem with Smith and Ricardo was that, quote, people happily traded raw materials and finished goods with each other across long distances, but would not trade intermediate goods or services. Let me just back that out because I know that was a mouthful. In other words, they treated the problem with Smith and Ricardo as a thought mistake. So there were people who had theories, and that's not what happened. Bippity-boppity, that's it. That's the explanation for the last 200 years. So that's one way in which it looks. The trade deficit, however, I would say, is a misrecognition of a problem. And this we can also see in another way in which it's talked today, and this is the other part of the title, Donald Trump. So Donald Trump, in his 2011 book, Time to Get Tough, wrote about Adam Smith. He wrote that while Smith's Wealth of Nations is usually summarized by, quote, people who know very little about capitalism, as saying, quote, in essence, that greed is good, what they leave out are that, quote, moral ground for markets, businesses, and life that Smith laid out in the theory of moral sentiments.
This is Trump.
This is a direct quote from Adam Smith.
Smith academic, I guess.
We're talking about thousands of pages by Adam Smith. Donald Trump is quoting from. So I'll quote him one more time. This is Trump, quote, open markets are the ideal, but if one guy is cheating the whole time, how is that free trade? So again, just coming back to the point, on the one hand, some people say, oh, Smith and Ricardo, they're just wrong. They just thought wrong, whatever, nice guys. Not right. And then you have Trump, who's like, no, somebody's cheating us. And so this is how the trade problem looks today. So consequently, the old arguments for free trade are considered moot. Trump's economic team have often appealed to what they call the theory of the second best. Right? It's not the first best, which is what I thought we were going to get. Now we get the second best. The important point is their sense that they are improving the market, that we're getting closer towards free trade. Our allies and rivals, we are told, subsidize their production, they protect their industries, they tariff their goods, they steal our intellectual property, and they abuse their comparative advantage of lower human rights. This might be all true. It is true. A lot of the American allies tariff the shit out of their goods, of course. But two wrongs don't make a right. Labor has no dog in the fight. Part of what Trump is doing here in this second term is carried over from the first term. He is also motivated by the fact that inflation, at least in that first term, we'll see what happens here, did not accelerate when they were applied during that first trade war. Phase one of the U.S.-China trade agreement was signed right at the beginning of 2020, but was quickly buried by something else, the COVID crisis. In fact, this is why Trump was even hesitant to sort of talk about the virus at the time, as he tweeted right after the trade agreement, quote, China has been working very hard to contain the coronavirus. The United States greatly appreciates their efforts and transparency. It will all work out well. Both that agreement and the USMCA, which we might talk about, I know it would be linked to the UAW discussion, have not turned out as was expected. Agricultural purchases were not followed through on, so China was supposed to buy from American farmers. Intellectual property has remained precarious. Fentanyl has become a geopolitical issue again. All of these things. So what is Trump doing with the tariffs? It's a shotgun blast. If companies are to dodge the USMCA rule of origin requirements to avoid paying workers $16 an hour, by the way, the UAW testified on Capitol Hill during the Biden administration on this. They were saying, oh, the most favored nation's tariff, like the 2.5%, is, you know, chump change compared to paying workers $16 an hour. Then Trump is just going to unload, for good or for evil, on the country of origin. I want to emphasize this does not just penalize competitors so much as American companies. What do I mean by that? Let's run through a seatbelt. Why not? Nylon fibers are manufactured in Mexico and are sent to Canada to be dyed and woven. There is cheaper water there. Only to be sent back to Mexico, the labor is then cheaper there, to be fitted onto buckles that are then installed in cars in either Mexico or the US by American-owned companies with investors from around the world.
The factories, the machines, the raw materials, the commodity futures, financing structure, and even the mixture of the factory paint on your car are the property of the company. To deliver the good, they must not only provide it in exact measurements, but the whole streamlined process, including to the, you know, the cute person at the dealership who like goes, you want to go for a test ride, and that's part of the use value right there. That's all part of the production. And yet, all of this material, all of the property counts as if it's labor. It would be as absurd as if I was to say, we have a gigantic factory that's just one thing, and yet the different parts of the factory relate to each other as if they're exchanging in the way that we did in Adam Smith's time. So there's like literally a contradiction, and yet people go, no, there's a trade deficit, there's a trade surplus, tariffs and stuff like that.
But this is all happening internally to a corporate balance.
Right, right. It's a global system and stuff like that. So that's why I'm saying, are tariffs good or bad? It's like, the whole point is to not fall for the, you know, one-sidedness of that. Yeah. And in fact, the trade deficit was not always a boogeyman. I don't know if you guys know this. Ronald Reagan told Cleveland in 1988, that trade deficits were, quote, a sign of strength of fast-growing economies experiencing net capital investment from abroad. But after 15 years, the trade deficit, which started to explode post-1980, this is what people started to talk about in the U.S., became a target. A common explanation for this growing wage inequality was the so-called skill bias change. We were just talking about this over there. Yeah. That is, the transformation of the economy was biased towards new kinds of production, right? This is why people have said the PMC, and they've talked about Silicon Valley and techs and everything like this. And so it seemed like you could have a shortage of labor, like we don't have enough coders, and yet also there were people in the Rust Belt who couldn't find a job. You could get both at the same time. And in fact, to quote Chris Cutrone, there's a famous phrase for this, he has an article on this, robots in sweatshops. Meaning you can get both in the United States. Of course you can. And we might be getting another version of that now. I think that's my point. So when Bill Clinton, in 1994, he felt he could take advantage of China opening up. So part of the background to neoliberalism was the fall of the Soviet Union. It was, to put it in economic terms, it was like a labor shock. It was just a lot of people came on board. And he thought he could take advantage of that to create a market for American workers in the post-1970 deindustrialization. This is what he said in his Uruguay round agreements. And for some time, and I'm putting this in quotes for the people listening, the neoliberal system worked. Quotes, worked. I'm not saying it was good, but it like trucked along. People worried about other things in the 90s or people listening to Marilyn Manson, this shit, right? It was something else.
That was something to worry about.
That was something to worry about. Oh, they're watching South Park. Okay, so not only NAFTA and the granting of China's permanent trade relations, this is really what kind of gave the China shock. That was another thing we're talking about. But the stagnating recovery of employment post-2008 compounded over time. The trade deficit was then characterized as if it was like an IV drip that was kind of keeping deindustrialized communities alive on imports and credit. This is where the politicization starts to creep in. As early as 2002, Dean Baker, a left-wing economist who Trump cited in 2016, warned that a run-up in home prices in the U.S. was built on an unsustainable accumulation of debt that was directly tied to the stagnation of wages among the working class. This allowed the trade deficit to be politicized, even if it's just an accounting identity. It's literally just an accounting identity. It's just numbers. One goes over there, the other goes over there. Nonetheless, it was a persistent symbol to people of deindustrialization. It's beginning with Reagan. It means something to people. In fact, the Unhedged podcast, these are the Financial Times people, just last week mocked Trump's narrative because they said, oh, he tries to draw a direct connection between everything, the trade deficit, the collapse of manufacturing, the opioid epidemic. And yet my response to them would be, but it's a compelling narrative. It has meant something to people. The volatility behind Trump's tariffs is really the manner in which they were done. We shouldn't forget Janet Yellen and Katherine Tai praised Trump's tariffs. We just got this in the administration. Biden put 100% tariffs on electric cars. Nobody talked about that. Okay, that happened. The volatility has to do with Trump's unilateral application, the politics. There is something to learn from Trump in flanking your opponents. He presents the terrorists as the, quote, most beautiful word in the dictionary. But at least ideologically, he presents it as setting right the American carnage. He has a story. And it's not, I'm not trying to just say storytelling, but politics has ideology. It's about how you organize people. It's how people can identify with things. We have been ripped off too long, he will say. Unlike the neoliberal era, where presidents were, quote, sanctions happy, Trump sees terrorists as preferable to sanctions. As he puts it, quote, sanctions kills your dollar and it kills everything the dollar represents. Mm. So while Ronald Reagan could tariff the motorcycles of our Japanese allies, 100% tariffs, I don't know if people know this, but sanctions are like, oh, you're a political outcast, right? Yeah, I know, Trump sanctions fucking everybody. That's fine. The point is the politics behind it. And this is really where I kind of want to end and make this point. At least there's a political economy to the tariffs, and so we have to be at least as good as that. When Peter Navarro was told that the Buy American executive order would increase costs, he responded by saying, no shit, Sherlock. Of course it's going to cost more to require that we buy American. But it's also going to create more jobs and strengthen our manufacturing and defense industrial base. Likewise, Scott Bessent said that the American dream is not, quote, let them eat flat screens.
Yeah.
So there's something about, like, the dignity of labor.
Yeah.
I know we were talking about the UAW. Martin Luther King gave a great speech at the UAW, the dignity of labor. There's like something to it. It's what it means to be part of the community. It is possible, and I'll end with this, that we will see a new kind of skill bias change in the labor market. The Stephen Miron Scott Bessent strategy has been to encourage domestic investment through tariffs, and we've seen this with Honda, Volkswagen, Stellantis, Hyundai, Taiwan Semiconductor. Low corporate tax rates, preserving the dollar's reserve currency, appreciating the dollar against importers to attenuate the inflation. I don't know if this will work, but things are going to change. India's curbing tariffs, and the EU, as of today, I was just watching Georgina Maloney talk about this, is like debating how reciprocal they're going to be. They're like, we don't really want to lose the US or something like that. So I don't know what's going to happen. Even the wage inequality between educated and uneducated workers was already shocked by the pandemic. There was a huge layoff in 2023. It was the year of efficiency. So the point being, the old problem might reappear under the old form. And we know this system harms all. The borrowing and financialization of the US economy is supported by the income inequality in Europe, but also in China in particular. Despite all the geopolitical bluster, there is an implicit agreement between the big box retail importers in the US and the members of the Communist Party of China who operate in the special economic zones. So just to end, how can we get out ahead of the coming change? So that was kind of my remarks to set things up. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm going to clap for that. We all can. Danny, I think that your prepared remarks really teed up a lot for us to discuss today. And I hope that in light of what you've said, that people kind of understand where we're getting at, what we're getting at with this thing. I would like to pass to Cyrus, and indeed pass the mic even, because at John Jay College, you with others have been working on this tariffs question from a political economic standpoint. Danny kind of gave us the politics and the ideology and sort of the background of tariffs. But what have you found in your research that like leads up to this moment? And where do you think perhaps this moment's taking us?
Yeah, thanks, Sean. And thank you so much for that excellent and thorough introduction. As some of you may have noted, I'm not Josh Mason, who was advertised on the flyer. I'm a bit of a last-minute substitute, so my remarks are a little off the back of the notepad, so to speak. But that to say, I'll try to respond to all the most important parts I thought of your introduction, and starting with the fact that, as you mentioned, tariffs in one respect, in a very singular, if you just look at them specifically, they make up a fairly small proportion of the U.S. economy. Many people might not know this, but the China shock that is so routinely talked about and NAFTA and deindustrialization that happened in the 1990s in the United States, the total jobs lost during that time were approximately 3 million, which, you know, is not an insignificant number, but in a workforce of roughly 160 million is pretty small in comparison to the rest of the economy. And at the start of that period in 1990, I believe U.S. GDP by imports made up 5% of U.S. GDP. Now, you know, 25 or 35 years later, imports make up 15% of U.S. GDP, which is, again, not an insignificant increase. But at the same time, U.S. GDP has increased five times, 500%. So while it's a change, undoubtedly, it's maybe not as big of a change in the specific impact of the tariffs as we might, or of free trade as we might often sort of think about. But that said, you know, I do have prepared remarks in a certain respect because I teach macroeconomics in a radical political economy program to a lot of students who, you know, this semester in particular, I feel like previous semesters I've had to, you know, tariff, they see that they hear that word and their eyes just glaze over. And this semester, the first day of class, they were all asking me, hey, what's the impact of the tariffs? And I'm like, wait, you guys know what that is? Oh, okay, well, that's...
They heard about it in their 19th century American history class.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
William McKinley's back in a big way.
He's back. So it's been a bit of an education for me in that sense, and specifically because of kind of, as you were alluding to, that they do actually affect in the way, in some ways, that Trump alludes to. They connect to many other parts of the economy. Labor markets, obviously, that's the most notable one, but asset markets. There's been a lot of talk on the Trump side economically about remanaging and restructuring government debt, which is heavily connected to this, which is obviously heavily connected to austerity and the reallocation of spending in the economy. And in particular, the weakening or strengthening of the U.S. dollar in comparison to other countries' currencies. So without getting too into the weeds on all of that, I think what is important for socialists to talk about when we're talking about tariffs is to try to apprehend, really, well, what is this going to result in the wider political economy? And that's, you know, I mean, I guess the subject of this panel, or at least it is as far as I'm considering it. But really, how that will affect the conditions of labor, both directly and indirectly. So as you mentioned, tariff regimes for other countries, you know, that they have, you know, if you, French wines or Italian cheeses or, you know, to name just a few, but you can look at any country and see significant tariffs that they've placed on the United States. And that is in large part due to the fact that those are part of a larger, much broader negotiation about labor costs in those countries. And those are sort of the relative gifts that we give them in exchange for the wider political economy that has created an American wealth that has, as I said, quintupled, 500% in the last 30 or so years. So that is, as you said, like, this could represent a much larger assault or sort of self-own on the United States. And my initial instinct does think that that is the case. But that said, we have to sort of examine what all the possibilities, what all the potential ramifications of that are. The USMCA dodging, that point in particular, as you mentioned and as we were talking about earlier.
Just to be clear, this is the renegotiation of NAFTA that happened under Trump between Mexico and Canada and the United States.
Right. And a big part of that, you know, there was heavy sanctions placed on Chinese chip manufacturing and other manufacturing. But in many respects, that just meant Chinese companies moved to places like Vietnam and Mexico and continued to trade robustly with the United States through the guise of a diversionary trade policy. And that has basically worked for both sides in the short to medium term. And it's a much larger open question as to whether or not Trump is willing to break that entire system. If he is, it brings up a lot bigger questions about what is the life of the American worker going to look like in the coming years? Because even in the best case scenario, as you said, you know, we don't have much control over this. We're not able to say what the outcomes are going to be. But ultimately they will, the first point of friction will come onto the American worker and the American consumer, which are the same person. Now, these effects are distributed unevenly, but ultimately the any good positive effects that could come from these tariffs will be delayed significantly. There, it takes a long time to bring American manufacturing back to the capacity that it had in the late 1980s or before that, which is kind of the language they talk about using, about manufacturing being the base of the American economy. So in the meantime, there's going to be a lot of people that are subject to economic deprivation, lack of economic opportunity, and without getting too far afield into a different subject, but the renegotiation of the social contract that's also happening at the same time in terms of...
Sam Altman told all of us that with the rise of artificial intelligence that we would have to renegotiate the social contract. So this is happening. Tariffs is a huge conversation, but we shouldn't ignore also that artificial intelligence and AI and the billions upon billions, maybe trillions of dollars going into that is another part of this broader shift.
And I think is most acutely felt at this specific time, or at least this is the sort of vague justification they're giving for the DOGE cuts. Which are happening primarily in the federal government, hundreds of thousands of workers potentially losing their livelihoods as a result of those cuts, which they're saying, oh, we can replace a lot of this work with AI. Maybe that's true, maybe that's not. But it opens up much broader questions about, well, where are these people going to work, if not in the white-collar, traditional white-collar workforce that neoliberalism that had worked up until this point in the way that you described sort of had a place for them. And it is not going to have a place for them. And, you know, I can see that on my students' faces as well, as they are students of the working class in, children of the working class in New York City who are going to college specifically because they think they're going to get those jobs. And those jobs are not going to exist, at least if this policy is fully pursued. And that's not even to mention that neoliberalism worked in the sense that it floated U.S. debt for the amount of time that it has so far to enable sort of super profits, in a sense, through the sale of U.S. treasuries, which allowed us to finance payments on interest. And also
the exorbitant privilege, as they call it.
Exorbitant right. privilege, exactly. And, you know, the United States is the only country that has been able to have a trade deficit, a persistent trade deficit for half a century without catastrophic economic effects for the country's economy. And that is basically due to the fact that we allow foreign countries. This deal that we've struck that has worked so far has enabled us to pursue a trade deficit, and in exchange, other countries buy U.S. assets. And that is something that if all the goals, this is why many of the goals of the Trump administration's tariff policy seem so contradictory, because on one hand, tariff policy should strengthen the dollar. On the other hand, controls on foreign currency exchange should weaken the dollar. But in any case, they seem to be pursuing both at the same time, trying to strike some sort of middle balance, which, as you said, the people at the Financial Times and Foreign Policy, you know, might make a mockery of, but they're not the ones with the power right now. So we have to take them at their word that this is what they're going to try to do and evaluate how exactly that's going to look. One final point I wanted to make, this idea of the dignity of labor, this dignity of labor point. You know, one interesting thing about these tariffs is that they've been so widespread across many sectors of industrial manufacturing. The Biden administration's tariff policies were targeted towards strategic goals, things like chip manufacturing, things like auto, electric vehicles, towards, you know, the tech economy, the manufacturing part of it, but the tech economy nonetheless. These blanket tariffs seem to speak to this larger Trump idea of a political economy that is tied, I think, to the quote-unquote crisis of masculinity, where American men or American workers in general feel like they don't have economic opportunity, that they don't have the dignity of labor in this traditional sense, or if they do, they work these sort of impotent office jobs that are stripping them of their testosterone.
Sure, and their vital juices, right?
Exactly. Their vital juices are pooling in the office chairs in which they sit. And
simultaneously baking under the fluorescent lights.
Exactly. Yeah. I can feel it already. and that there's this idea that, well, we're going to make the American factory worker a part of the culture again in a way it has not been over the last half century or so, or it has degraded over the last half century or so. Now, I think a question we need to ask ourselves as socialists and as strategists of working class organization is, well, does making American workers, sending them back into t-shirt factories again, is that really what American workers want? Is to be at an assembly line printing graphic tees, or making paper products, or making, you know, cheap textiles of any kind, and that is going to satisfy them? And I personally don't think that it will. I think that is the lure to try and bring them back in to the, you know, sort of the Trumpist fold of economic policy. But I have serious doubts about whether or not that will be successful. And so that's another thing that I think we need to consider heavily as we talk about, well, what does this mean for us as organizers?
Hell yeah. Thank you, Cyrus. Good remarks. Ryan, I see, as you represent MCU here, you've got not only a prepared statement, but you also have a lot of notes. So when you're ready, hit us with it. We're ready to hear what you have to say about what Danny and Cyrus said, and also what you have to say generally about tariffs and Trump and all that good stuff. So hit us.
First, thanks for having me here. Second,
yes,
these are actually just notes of recent developments with Trump's tariffs. And then I took some notes as you all were talking. I want to step back a little bit and just talk about these tariffs and the shift away from neoliberalism. Because there's been, I think, great confusion on the U.S. left for the past, while, but especially in the last 20, 30 years, where repeatedly neoliberalism has been used basically synonymously with capitalism, with the policy of the bourgeoisie. But this is fundamentally indicative of our collective amnesia, of the inability or challenges, not inability, but at least limitations of the left in the U.S. and of Marxists, a lot of Marxists, to really do some basic research on U.S. policy, economic and political policy, and on the history of political economy. Because neoliberalism as an ideology, an economic policy, and a political policy really came into being and was adopted by the majority of the ruling class in the U.S., became their consensus view in the early 80s. After the stagflation of the 70s, the shift of the dollar away from the breakdown of the Bretton Woods system, really, and, you know, 10 years of prolonged was called stagflation. As a side note, if you look at the prices of commodities in that period in gold prices, you'll see the 1970s followed a classical economic depression. That is, prices fell across the board. But in dollar prices, they rose because of the debasement of the dollar. That's a side point, but it's relevant. And I'll come back to it in a bit.
You're arguing as a classic deflationary crisis like we saw in maybe the 1870s and 80s.
Yeah, or the 30s. Yeah,
or the
exactly.
1930s.
Exactly.
Okay.
And,
but it wasn't recognized as such.
It wasn't recognized as such. And so the shift to what was first called monetarism and then neoliberalism was waged. First, that battle was waged in the ruling class on the ideological plane. Paul Samuelson, the leading representative of neo-Keynesianism, debated Milton Friedman like every week in a Newsweek column they had. And they went back and forth and back and forth on these questions. And eventually the public was won over, a lot of the ruling class was won over to Friedman's theories. And the Federal Reserve Board sort of was won over, but they said it was useful for them to justify the interest rate shock, shifting to monetary targeting of the amount of dollars in circulation to justify spiking up the interest rate very high, as was done by Volcker, to then stop outflows of capital from the U.S. market and pull them back in. But this led to, very quickly, a shift in capital away from a lot of production, away from industrial production, and towards money capital, that is, loaning the capital. And this is where we saw the creation of the Rust Belt and the beginning of the adoption of neoliberal policies. Now, this was only possible for the U.S., the broad shift to neoliberalism, which involved really cutting down a lot of tariffs, although Reagan did actually increase some tariffs, and the elimination of the barriers to the free flow of capital globally because of the strategic decline of the U.S. ruling class's major rival, namely the Soviet Union, which in my view by that point had restored capitalism and was a rival imperialist power. And by the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, you have the adoption of the Washington Consensus, which is kind of the baseline neoliberal policies across the board. And it's very advantageous for the U.S. ruling class to do this. They can spread their capital over the world much easier. They break down all barriers to inflows of U.S. capital. Not all, but a good deal of them. And we have the neoliberal era. This has come to an end now, I think. And I wrote a long paper on it that's published on our website that you can read. With the rise of China as a rival imperialist power, exporting capital around the world with global monopolies capable of going toe-to-toe with European and U.S. monopolies and often out-competing them, even producing sometimes higher quality products. And this strategy and form of class rule of neoliberalism, economic policy, political policy, ideological policy, is no longer possible. Now, the challenge for the U.S. ruling class, as was outlined a couple of years ago in a bipartisan congressional report by the House, is that the United States government and has never faced, in the ruling class, not just the government, has never faced a situation where they're so economically interdependent with their major rival. During the period with the Soviet Union, first when it was socialist, then when capitalism was restored, there was relatively separate economic spheres. Prior to that, with the system of old-style colonialism, the colonies were relatively separate. There was trade and trust agreements, but the level of trade and economic integration and the dependence of the U.S. economy on foreign production was far less than it is today. And therefore, the U.S. ruling class, the section of them that really does believe that they need to make major changes to defeat the Chinese ruling class, or at least go toe-to-toe with them, in their rivalry for global dominance, believes that major changes are needed. Now, to be clear, this has not been a total consensus view. There are significant sections of the ruling class that argued for a peaceful repartition of the world with the U.S. and China, actually through the World Economic Forum, and a new social contract, which was called the Great Reset. There was a lot of right-wing conspiracies about this, but this was a real thing, and their slogan really was, "You will own nothing and be happy," which is pretty fucking dystopian.
Bad branding.
Yeah, really bad branding. I mean, what are they thinking? But that view of extending the neoliberal order, of allowing the Chinese ruling class to take a greater share of things, of redividing things somewhat, it's lost out. It started to lose out after 2008, as was already alluded to. And we saw the first shift away from neoliberal policy with the efforts to massively subsidize the domestic fossil fuel industry, where the U.S. went from the largest importer of oil in the world to a huge exporter of oil, and I think the second largest producer right now, maybe currently largest, and the largest exporter of LNG. And this shift now is being intensified beyond just critical industries like oil. We've seen this, as other panelists have already alluded to, with the CHIPS Act, with the first round of the trade war, and so on. We've seen a number of companies investing huge amounts of capital to the tunes of tens of billions of dollars a year in the U.S. in major U.S. government subsidies to facilitate the really expansion of domestic manufacturing. As was already alluded to, there was real loss of jobs and there was the creation of the Rust Belt, but the U.S. still is the second largest industrial power in the world after China, and so there's already a significant industrial base here on which to build. But there's key inputs that are missing. Rare earths, key chip technology, obviously, some of the steel manufacturing, which is still there but needs to be expanded to match domestic demand. And these policies, they aim, as I alluded to earlier, to somewhat, it's not possible totally, but to somewhat decouple the U.S. and Chinese economy. And I think short of a world war, it's not really possible. It can happen, obviously, but I think it's not in the short term, although initially Trump went on the campaign trail, talked about a four-year plan to decouple the U.S. from China. It's just not feasible. So these policies and tariffs aim to do that. Now, the U.S. economy will not return to a classical mercantilism of like early Italian city-states. The U.S. is a global imperialist power and needs to maintain its global dominance. It needs to keep shipping going globally. It needs trade. It needs to export huge amounts of capital to countries around the world. And so what we're seeing is these tariffs, I like the metaphor used, is a shotgun approach. Threaten 25% tariffs on South Korean auto manufacturers. And then, oh, Hyundai agrees to invest $20 billion, not only in new auto manufacturing, but also new steel plant in Louisiana, cooperation on national security lines with Boston Dynamics, that company that makes those robot dogs, collaboration on AI and chip making and drones across the board. And what we're seeing, and we shouldn't take this lightly, this isn't just a matter of rhetoric, is the Trump administration, and actually the Biden administration did the same thing, talking about these as a matter of national security. That is a fundamental question of the preservation of U.S. global dominance. And that's really the challenge that they're dealing with in terms of competition internationally with China. So getting a whole bunch of U.S. allies, for example, like South Korea, that does a large amount of trade with China, or like Vietnam, that's a very close trading partner with the U.S., to agree to conditions which are exceedingly favorable to the United States and their trade agreements and their capital relations and capital investment and so on, and to push them to decrease to some degree and more if they can, their relations with China. And this has put a lot of companies and whole countries into big pickles because the U.S., both the Biden administration and the first Trump administration, and I'm sure we'll see more of it, will often unilaterally tell an ally with very little forewarning that they may need to make major changes to their trade with China on short notice. This happened to Japan and Taiwan and caused major problems for the ruling classes in those countries domestically. So I emphasize that to emphasize the sloppiness and the messiness which has characterized the U.S. ruling class and their policies for a while, and to not give a sense that they're all powerful or this is a perfectly thought-out plan. It's very messy. There's a lot of contradictions, but this is the broad strokes of it. In terms of changing the social contract, this has to be sold domestically. The other panelists have already done a good job highlighting some key aspects of that. I want to emphasize a few more. And I think these are things not to be taken lightly. We saw, for example, Trump's massive spike in popularity amongst non-white voters. It's not possible to, it wasn't correct the first time around, but with Trump 1.0, but it's definitely not possible now to blame it all on white Cubans or something like that, as some people on the left have done. I mean, yeah, a lot of like anti-communist Cubans do in the U.S. do love Trump, but it's much bigger phenomenon than that.
Some of them even joined his administration.
Exactly.
Secretary of State,
exactly.
Yeah.
But there's a real form of what we've called neo-nativist ideology that the Trump administration has been promoting quite successfully in the ideological realm as part of this regime of tariffs and border control and so on, to really convince even, for example, a lot of Hispanic voters who have some legal status, citizenship or green cards, to really take up anti-migrant policies and politics. And there's more to be said about that, but it's more expansive and dynamic and dangerous than a lot of what the U.S. left has been calling it. Oh, it's just white supremacy or something like that. Of course, there is white supremacy in the U.S., but to reduce the ideology that's being put forward with this shift to neo-mercantilism just to white supremacy is to actually engage in what Marx called a violent abstraction, to just take part of the reality and ignore huge and important and essential aspects to what's going on. Yeah, there's a lot more to say about all this. Go ahead.
I wasn't going to cut you off at all. I was going to say continue if you wish. I mean, I could take things in a direction.
Let me just say one more thing
finish?
To wrap
yeah,
up.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
So what we'll see and what we're seeing is with a bunch of countries that are either less powerful imperialist powers or countries which are oppressed by imperialism overall, they're being forced to reckon with the fact that they will need to increasingly subordinate their interests to the U.S. ruling class. And there's sharp contradictions emerging there, and I'll talk about those in 1 second. But, you know, even amongst allied capitalist powers, there's sharp contradictions. There just are. You know, we saw this, for example, with the contradictions between the U.S. and the Japanese ruling classes, as you alluded to, with the motorcycle tariffs and so on. But these are intensifying as the competition between the U.S. and its main rivals, Russia and China, intensify. But also they're intensifying with the European allies. And people may or may not know, But the Bretton Woods system collapsed for a lot of reasons. But one of them was the sharp, sharp contradictions that existed between the U.S. and its European allies, where the West Germany and France were very, very upset with the division of the world between them that had been agreed between them and the U.S. post-World War II. They had grown more powerful relative to the U.S. since the end of World War II and wanted to renegotiate the terms of their division of the spoils of the world market. And actually, interestingly, the nuclear weapons was a big question there, and France is now talking about expanding its nuclear umbrella to the rest of Europe. So actually, in the last year, and part of this whole tariff thing, we have to look very closely at the U.S.-Europe relations, not through the typical liberal framework of, oh my God, Trump is torpedoing things, years of diplomatic work and is acting unilaterally, but through a real Marxist analysis. The European ruling classes are trying to more closely unify, especially under the leadership of the French and German ruling classes, and to really put forward, as Mario Draghi, former head of the ECB, a plan for strategic autonomy. He put this forward last year, for the European Union to set up its strategic independence from both the US and China, not just economically, but militarily. And there's sharp contradictions emerging there, where a lot of European countries are very dependent on the U.S. defense umbrella, not just nuclear weapons, but F-35s, et cetera. And so there's an effort to build up an entirely independent domestic military supply chain. At the same time, major German companies are taking out new contracts to build more parts for the F-35. So we're going to see an intensification of contradictions in the enemy camp at the international level, but also nationally in the U.S. and in different countries around the world. And that will provide more openings for the working class. I agree with what you said in terms of the tariffs we shouldn't take aside. At the same time, if there are a lot more working class jobs here in the U.S. and industrial jobs, that is advantageous for Marxists. And the ruling class in the U.S., in order to have enough skilled workers to do these jobs, like shipbuilding, right now China builds 262 times as many ships as the U.S. every year. 262 times, I did not misspeak. They need the unions and the skilled labor that the unions training programs can provide. And so there's openings there, but also dangers there, because we need to understand, and I will conclude on this point, the lessons from the betrayal of the Communist Party USA in the 30s with their capitulation to not only the U.S. ruling class broadly, but also their tailing of the CIO leaders, the ways in which they really tailed behind the union leadership when they should have pursued an independent working class policy. And if we can sum up those lessons and we can take advantage of the openings that are going to arise with this regime of tariffs and the broader efforts to decouple the U.S. and China and the inevitable influx and increase in working class jobs, and the increase in union jobs, which I think will happen to some degree, even as government union jobs decrease with DOGE.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you. How do I, as your humble moderator here, sum up all of this? It seems to me like, Cyrus, you want to directly respond, maybe?
I mean, if you have another question, I'm happy to let you take it.
No, I was going to... We're lacking Brandon from the United Auto Workers International Board. There was a mix-up, and he couldn't make it today. He was meant to be here as a representative of, like, an actually existing workers institution, which is the United Auto Workers, one that's... been in the news for a lot of good reasons over the last several years, not least of which because they both went up against the Biden administration, but also ultimately fell in line with the Biden administration when it came to a massive change towards electric vehicle production in the United States, basically like a massive government subsidy in order to retool the American auto industry, American auto capital, you could say, to produce cars in a different way, different types of cars in a different way. Of course, needing less workers, so you would need the UAW on board with that. We don't have anybody from the UAW here today, but we do have me. And I suppose, in a sense, I'm an industrial worker. Is construction industrial work? I guess it is.
For our purposes, we'll
call heavy construction industrial work. I must say that we're, what, 2.5 months into the second Trump administration?
Time flies when you're having fun.
Time flies when you're having fun, that's right. We've been facing a lot more than tariffs and prices of goods, which we, who handle the goods, who convert those goods into buildings and infrastructure or whatever, we're not quite so affected by that, except downstream when it comes to prices that producers pay for them. But what has affected us greatly, I think, is the DOGE cuts And the more I talk to people, and I'm not just talking about ILC people, but this includes ILC people, it includes people in my own life, in my own family, it includes friends, it feels as though layoffs, not just Doge layoffs, but layoffs keep coming down the pipe. More and more people I hear say they're being laid off, which leads us to, I think, assume that there's something like a jobs recession happening. People on the right have argued that there's been a recession, that the inflation under Biden, the stagflation, if you want to call it, under Biden, represented a real recession, which could be seen everywhere except, of course, in employment. Unemployment numbers remaining very low up until this day, I think something like 3 or 4%, historically low official unemployment numbers. Nevertheless, with the chaos of this new administration, with the tariffs, with the Doge cuts, with the fact that the market's been shaken up a bit, you know, the fact that equities and assets have been threatened by this new tariffs regime and whatever, we're now starting to feel something that looks like a jobs recession coming down the pipe. So I would be interested with all of us sitting in this room right here, especially people who are younger, who maybe didn't live through 2008. Hell, I'm old enough to have lived through the dot-com bubble, right? To maybe think about, and this will help us, I think, transition maybe towards the town hall when we could talk about this more generally amongst ourselves, like what it would look like to pass through a recession at this point in time. Maybe we haven't had a recession, a true jobs recession, in 15 years, longer than that, 16 years, right? Since COVID. 2008 to that. COVID was a weird thing that happened. Maybe COVID is like in the background here of this conversation and like dwelling there like
can
a heart, like a monster.
To that,
yeah, please do. Maybe COVID is a way to explain this. Go ahead.
Okay, so first of all, I don't want anybody to lose their job. That's my official position that it's on the thing right there. Okay. The reason I say that is that when COVID broke out, there were people who knew, oh, that job is not coming back for me. There were protests in Michigan. You remember that? But no, it was far right, was what it was called. Okay, so I say that because, like, I was reading the Wall Street Journal, and of course they were asking Trump voters, and don't shoot the messenger what I'm about to say, but they had resentment towards, you know, the people complaining about Doge. I hate this. I don't want the workers to be against each other. I don't want people to go, good, you're getting your comeuppance. But they had this kind of like, you didn't care when we lost our job kind of thing. And yeah. So, you know, like, to me, I'm just trying to bring up, like, okay, there were times when the left had focused on some people being unemployed and times when it didn't. I know now I used the other word that's not quite working class, it's the left. Mm. But, like, that was a running theme in the last basically 10 years is why didn't the left do something with the people in the Rust Belt? Like, yes, it might have only been 2 million jobs. But those are jobs that are part of a family, and it's part of a community, and things spill over, right? It's not just somebody lost a job. It's that entire communities, and people aren't buying things, and people have, you know, family members in jail and in prison, and then
fentanyl,
this is the fentanyl thing. It's like Trump brings that up, and they mock that, saying that it's not connected.
They're financial analysts, that's why. But no, the reason I bring that up is that it's like, when I read the Wall Street Journal article, I hated what I was reading, and yet I got it without wanting to really get it, that they were resentful in a certain way, that they were like, oh, now you care. So I'm just putting that point out there.
I think it's a very valid point, and I think that there was a lot of hemming and hawing, if you guys remember, 8 years ago or so, about economic anxiety. Remember economic anxiety? This was a way to try to disaggregate Trump's first election from like the race question or nationality question. It was to say that people were feeling economic anxiety. I want to go back to the narrative. Was it Cyrus? You were the one that was pointing to like Trump's ability, the right's ability to create a sort of holistic analysis around these issues, to tie fentanyl, for example, to the Rust Belt. We ourselves, I don't think, want a demagogue like that. But we certainly need to admit that it's been useful and it's been a powerful thing. So maybe like as we continue this conversation, the questions might be like, what does this shift look like? It's something we've addressed already, but also like what's it going to be like to pass through a recession? remember, Ronald Reagan very successfully had a recession. He had a great recession. Great for him politically, right? What, 1981 to like 1983, you had massive job loss. You had like a reconsolidation of capital. You had consolidation. You had hedge funds. They weren't called hedge funds. Private equity is what they call them back then. Private equity coming in and like eliminating corporate raiders, you know, all this stuff. Like, what does it feel like? What's it going to feel like? What are the opportunities that might arise if we are to pass through a recession, if we are to be once more disabused that, like, capital can be, like, adequately restrained and regulated by the state? Because, and I'll leave it with this, like, this whole conversation, all three of you, and what I've been saying, too, I'd like to point out that, like, all this discussion with about auto workers, about tariffs, about the $3 trillion that Trump managed to get invested from foreign investors in the United States, this all points to an implication of the capitalist state in the private economy in a way that maybe we find natural nowadays. And like the opposite of that ideologically, like libertarianism, seems to offer, or like post-neoliberalism seems to offer, a return to a sort of laissez-faire economy where these things might happen spontaneously and automatically. But the point is like, to even imagine them happening spontaneously, you need massive government intervention. So what the fuck does that mean? So two questions for the panel. The first is like, what will it be like as socialists to live through a recession? And what are the opportunities of that? And what does it say that like, the only way we can imagine a laissez-faire economy coming back is through massive tariff interventions or other sorts of subsidies in order to bring back like the animal spirits of the market. I think Cyrus and then Ryan will go.
Yeah, I can start with that. And I think, you know, the way you kind of framed that last question, it's Trump's version of a great reset, right? It is his version of the economy as it stands now has been a phantom, a fantasy, a delusion that we've all been collectively operating under, and we're going to bring it back to a real economy, whatever that means. And to your point about, you know, this is not a return to the era of high colonial mercantilism of the Spanish Empire and the British Empire of the late 17th and 18th century, late 18th and 19th, but that to say, it is a return to the war of all against all, right? The essence of capitalist competition, but from an interstate perspective, that is the best way to keep capitalism strong, is to have the capitalist countries in strong competition with each other. Well, the end of the spectrum of competition, the most radical form of competition, is war. Mm. And that narrative that's being pitched, whether it's, you know, it's abstracted right now, but that war is a purpose for Americans, right? That is what war is a mission, a goal, something we can collectively work towards, something that is, I think, something socialists should be able to tap into, which is a desire for collective endeavor. And when that's in the context of a recessionary environment, right, there's a sense of self-sacrifice, but also a sense that that gives the workers extra leverage. Right. If the stakes of the competition are that high, then that means the capacity of the workers to generate leverage is higher. Now, the question I think that we haven't broached at all in this topic, there's been a lot of talk about the 70s and stagflation, right? But one major structural shift that happened during that time is the imperialist West's attitude and orientation towards the global South. Through structural adjustments, through keeping wages low, through the crushing of the labor movement, both here, but especially in the third worldist movement, and that as a necessary factor in keeping prices stable and low here in the United States, to keep the prices of raw inputs and raw materials low abroad. So that's, again, why the United States obviously has to stay involved. It can't descend into total autarky or mercantilism because it needs those raw resources. And it can't, well, at least right now, it doesn't seem like it can get them just from extracting them through theft, through total theft. But that said, I think this at this time, right, this is the difficulty that we need to try to strive for, is the American chauvinism. And you said it's not white supremacy, but there is a shift, I think, towards American supremacy. That if you're considered part of this polity, then you have certain privileges that are make you better and make you more deserving and more privileged of the benefits of empire than someone else, which is why different ethnicities and racial groups have been sort of brought into the fold slowly, unevenly, with some, you know, hiccups along the way. But eventually there is an effort to bring those racial groups into the polity in order to punish and in order to threaten the enemies of the benefits of the privileges of empire. So internationalism as a socialist is going to become increasingly important. And it's why, I mean, it's in some ways it makes the brilliance of the tariffs, or it illustrates the brilliance of the tariffs as setting up a deliberate obstacle between that solidarity between working people in Central and South America, in Southeast Asia, against the interests of working people in the United States. Now, the broader question of, well, how do we leverage the specific privileges of being in a potentially warlike recessionary economy versus having solidarity with other working class groups. I mean, I think that's incumbent upon socialist organizers to craft a different narrative, right? That shows that the benefits of American empire and American privilege, right, are going to become even more phantom-like and illusory over time. Like, not to go back to the T-shirt factory thing, but if that's the best that they can offer is a slightly above minimum wage position in manufacturing with totally ameliorated healthcare benefits, with a disastrous foreign policy that will almost certainly result in some form of war, even if it's proxy, while U.S. debt continues to escalate, you know, catastrophically. Well, I don't think that is an opportunity to present a different narrative. So we're kind of in a wait and see period, I think, where you just kind of have to wait for people to feel the actual effects of these policies and to have a ready-made prescription, alternative narrative, and program for them to join into that says, hey, American supremacy, actually, it's not going to get you that many benefits. If it did, it would be a harder pitch, but I don't think it will.
Let's, moving towards the town hall, we had Cyrus's word. Let's do Ryan, and then maybe Danny, you'll close us out, and then we'll have some pizza. So, Ryan, go ahead. Responses to the questions.
So, first, on the question of a recession, yeah, I think 2019, 2020 was the beginnings of one. We saw the Federal Reserve start to cut interest rates, which the Federal Reserve doesn't really properly set interest rates. It can within certain bounds. It follows the interbank lending, actually, and pays a great price if it doesn't. So we started to see, actually, the beginnings of that, and then COVID hit, and we had a very accelerated recession, depression, and then rebound in commodity prices very rapidly. I think we're still a little bit of a ways off from the beginning of a crisis and then a depression, to use the classical term, recession, then depression, the prolonged stagnation. And we can see that because gold prices in dollar terms are still rising. Generally, what happens is once a crisis really starts to hit and you have a proper recession, we see gold prices actually fall as people flee into the dollar once the Federal Reserve starts cutting interest rates and the interbank lending markets change and commodity prices go down to some degree, either in nominal dollar terms or in gold terms. That said, it really depends on the depth of the crisis and economic dislocation that we see. We will eventually see another recession, whether it comes in a few years, if it's starting now, or if it follows roughly the decennial cycle and ends up in about 10 years. In a severe economic depression and downturn like 2008 or worse, historically, we have not seen immediately an uptick in the working class movement. This was actually a mistake of the CPUSA and the Comintern in the late 20s. There was an assumption with the impending crisis in capitalism, which they saw well, that there would be automatically and quickly a radicalization of the working class movement around the world, but especially in the U.S., where then the crisis hit very hard. It really took until the year 1933, until the beginning of some elements of a recovery, and then also obviously the passage of the National Labor Relations Act, to see a big uptick in working class strike activity. So it is possible that it may take some years after the immediate downturn. It wasn't, properly speaking, like a working class movement. It was more heterogeneous in class terms, but it took a few years after the 2008 crisis to get Occupy. It's not uncommon for that sort of thing to take some time. But generally, even at the stage of being small propaganda groups, if Marxists can expose the flaws in the ruling class narrative during recessions, which are very painful for the masses of people, it creates big openings to, once popular movements and the working class movement in particular begin to pick up, to really make some advances. And historically, it's been at times where not only there's a big economic downturn, but this often goes hand in hand, there's a need for the ruling class to shift to some degree their form of class rule. To be clear, we're talking about one form or another of bourgeois class dictatorship, the dictator class dictatorship of the bourgeoisie over the masses of people, whether that remains bourgeois democracy but changes in form from Keynesianism to neoliberalism or shifts to fascism. To be clear, Trump is not bringing fascism in my view. But when those ideological shifts are necessary in political and economic shifts for the ruling class, even just within bourgeois democracy, as we saw to neoliberalism, there are huge openings to win people away from the ruling class narrative, because it hasn't really fully solidified yet, as you were alluding to. And there's real openings to clarify to people that their interest lies not in aligning with the corporations in the U.S. government, but with international working class. And I see Colleen right there with Teamsters Mobilize shirt on. I don't know if Chantel, you're wearing yours too, but some of our comrades are in Teamsters. And obviously Sean O'Brien had the sort of infamy of speaking at the RNC and really being on somewhat of the general president of the Teamsters Union, being on the cutting edge of putting forward some of this like American workers first ideology, which is still rough around the edges. And he has, if he was a video game character, zero charisma stat. So that is advantageous. For us, but they are really the ruling class and their collaborators, the labor misleaders of labor in the unions, are really working to try to figure this thing out, smooth out the rough edges, and win workers over to this. And especially if, as we anticipate in MCU, the ruling class will need to depend more on the unions to expand domestic production, especially for skilled work, this will be all the more important to combat and expose. And sorry, can you remind me, what's the second part of your question? I had one small point on that. A second question.
Well, there was the question about the recession, and then the other one was about the implication of the bourgeois state within production and accumulation.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and its results, the results of accumulation.
Yeah, so I want to be clear. I think there really was never a laissez-faire period where the state wasn't heavily involved, in capitalism from the beginning. They're involved in production, as sometimes they say, picking winners and losers. But with the development of large-scale monopolistic corporations that dominate nearly all aspects of economic life, the state, as an excrescence in the society, takes on such massively larger proportions. I mean, just look at how much the U.S. government has determined industrial production in the defense sphere, the military sphere, since World War II and before. It's a massive amount. So even when the U.S. in the neoliberal era shifted away from some more explicit government direct control in industrial policy outside of the military sphere, that still existed there. What's more, the government still had massive expenditure to support huge corporations, big banks, et cetera. We saw that with the bailouts, but even before then. What we're seeing now is a more conscious effort by the ruling class to direct and control production to meet their strategic objectives in competition with their major rivals and to cow down their allies to accept a subordinate position or a more subordinate position. And I think that's the difference we're seeing. And I think there will be no return to the imagined promised land of laissez-faire capitalism.
All right. Thank you, Ryan. You get some class for that. And back to where we started. Danny, take us home. Wrap all this up for us, the two questions at hand, and also anything else you want to add.
Yeah,
right ahead.
I want to read something. This is from January 4th, 2024. Entering 2023, more than 85% of economists expected a U.S. recession before the year's end. This was just 2 years ago. Okay. They had good reason. The yield curve, usually a harbinger of recession, inverted in July 2022 when rates for the two-year Treasury bonds surpassed those for 10-year bonds. Meanwhile, on Main Street, Google searches for the term recession hit the highest mark in history. Okay, so why am I saying this? There might not be a recession. There might not be 2008 again. Meaning, I looking around the room, we're all kind of a similar cohort, I think, I'm guessing. Fucking 2008 was a moment for us. That's what I was saying, is that, like, you know, I got out of college. I went for economics and math because I'm a nerd. And I worked at a Bed Bath & Beyond.
Yeah.
And then I worked on a cruise ship. Nice. I did not need a...
Light below deck on Bravo.
I did not need a degree for either of those. Okay? So I'm saying this because for a lot of us in this room, that was a pivotal moment in our lives. And so I feel like anytime the stock market dips... Which, yes, I know there's a difference between the stock market and the economy. We're like, oh, it's happening again. It's happening again. It's happening again. So it might not happen, right?
Or we want a motor. We want history to have a motor, and we are primed to see another 2008 around the horizon at all times.
You know, people organized in prosperous periods.
Yeah, indeed.
The largest socialist party in the world was during a prosperous period, right?
And Marx has predicted 10 of the last four recessions.
Marx has predicted 10 of the last five recessions. Apparently, the mainstream economists aren't good at that. And so I'm not trying to, like, say everything's going to be good, but it could be a recession in a muted way, in a way that's not as we've kind of expected from 2008, where you have like double-digit unemployment that seems to lag on forever. I remember going for a job interview, and it was me and a 40-year-old man with like children who had worked at the office versus me, and I was like, I don't have no idea why I'm here, because of course he's going to get the job. He has the experience. So I feel like that has impacted how we think of things. I would even... garner that probably the reason us three nerds are interested in economics is because it was a hot topic after 2008. Like, oh, we can't trust the Federal Reserve people. We're going to go on blogs and read this heterodox stuff. Yeah. Oh, I think I'm right
Tyler
about
Cohen
that. Yeah, I know, guys. I know. I know. Okay, so that might happen.
For me, it was libcom.org.
Yeah, because yeah, it was like, boards. I can't trust Alan Greenspan, so I'm going to trust these other people.
Turns out Alan Greenspan couldn't even trust himself.
Alan Greenspan couldn't trust himself. All those times with Ayn Rand in the 60s. So the second thing was then the state kind of thing. And so I wanted to come back to the dignity of labor. So I wasn't trying to say, and I'm not saying that this is what you're saying, that the dignity of labor, like it's a Bruce Springsteen song, we're in a factory or something. But the dignity of labor was Adam Smith, that every single person matters and is irreplaceable. Because Adam Smith's vision of society was that we can always find a place for anybody. Mm. We can always change the division of labor. We can find something new. We can find a new specialty for you. And so in terms of relating to the working class, I don't know that maybe Marxism or socialism is the thing, but just talking to people about their job and that they're like proud of what they do. And when I think of like the political independence of the working class, it's driven not by, oh, we're in a recession, I want greater unemployment. It's, I can do this. Mm. We can do this. Why the fuck do we need them? Mm. Right? It's like driven by that kind of like edge of, we really don't need them. What are they doing? They're kind of bungling things. And we know how to do this. We know how to run these factories. We know how to run these places. We know how to run these shops. We take care of each other.
Every cook can govern.
We can guard ourselves. We have defense communities. When there's a fight that breaks out, we're the ones that break it up. And, you know, even thinking back to, and this is in the Constitution, I don't know if people know this, your inalienable rights. Oh, you're getting a note? Okay.
I'm getting a note that pizza arrives in 10 minutes. Question mark. Try to stall.
I was in the moment. Yeah.
Filibuster, it's, go ahead,
okay,
please.
I got to catch my... No, you're... So, here, I'll bring up a case that's in the news right now. So, Mahmoud Khalil.
Ah, yeah.
Okay? Yeah. What is the first thing? Is that an infringement upon his civil rights? Okay. Where do those civil rights come from? They come from him being a laborer, in fact. That's your inalienable right. That's your right that to your body. Like, when people say this, my bodily autonomy, my right to associate with people, that's what a protest is. That's what we're doing, we're associating. It comes from the modern bourgeois society, the labor society. So when I think about this question of the state in society, it's like, what rights do we have against the state? It's your labor rights. And so again, in terms of these questions of like, Yeah, I don't know. Are they going to be involved in things? Are they going to try to do Tech Valley, as I just learned, up in upstate New York? They're going to try to have Micron up there? Yeah, fuck it. Whatever. They're going to try these things. And some things will work. Some things will not work. I don't want to try to predict a recession. But I'm just thinking of, what is the question of labor? What does it mean to be independent labor? How can you relate to people on that basis? I would love to talk about Marx and everything like that, but I feel like we have to earn it. You have to actually kind of earn why it would even mean something.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been one of the reasons why it's been useful to have Platypus in this conversation is I think because of this, I don't want to call it aphorism or maxim, but I think a guiding light perhaps should be that we need to, like, if we're going to be Marxists, we need to earn it.
Earn it, yeah.
Because Marxism isn't just like the best type of socialism that exists. Marxism is like an internal critique of socialism itself. So how do we understand ourselves? Now I'm going to soapbox. I'm going to filibuster. I'm going to take up some time. Hey, all right, here I go. Like, how do we understand ourselves as the independent labor club vis-a-vis other groups, but vis-a-vis society and the working class at large is, you know, largely understanding that working class independence is the necessary precondition for all the other things that follow from what we would imagine like a Marxist or a socialist movement should look like. And that in fact, like the, if I can create a word, the de-independence or the unindependence, the lashing of the working class in the United States and elsewhere to various capitalist parties and to the state has meant that like necessary processes of political self-political education, political growth, that the working class in this country, the working class broadly conceived in this country, learned between, let's say, the years 1865 and 1905 or, you know, 1920. Like, these are processes that in the past have garnered something that looks like a vital and independent working class movement and party, right, that actually claimed to uphold socialist values. If we look to have that, it's not going to come from the technocrats within the Democratic Party. It's not going to come from the Federal Reserve. It's not going to come from passing the right regulations or, you know, having the right, having AOC as the president, presidential candidate in 2008, which apparently is something that's in the offing. That shows how desperate they are, I guess, right? But instead that that this movement of the working class must necessarily arise not from the ideas of intellectuals, but instead as a bottom-up movement within civil society, within the broader society that seeks to answer questions that society itself is posing right now. Like, all right, so we as socialists, as communists, as anarchists, whatever it is we are, we have no effect over government policy. We have no effect over Doge. Elon Musk is going in there with a wrecking ball and he's smashing shit up. My mother sent me a frantic text message the other day. She's afraid she's not going to get her Social Security check. Frightening stuff, you know? God forbid they scare your mom, of all people, you know? Because you have to deal with it first off. I know, my mother. But like, it's not to say that we in the ILC or any other group right now has the capacity to make up the Social Security Administration of the United States. It's only to say that like, we appear to have reached a moment in history where our preconceptions about what it is that the state does, the interaction between civil society and the state, the intimate connection between the American working class and one particular capitalist party seems to have broken down. So we as socialists, we who believe that a new world is possible, a better world is possible, that this society that we have right now is leading or necessarily leads to something that looks better and different, we need to grasp this at its radical roots and understand that like there was a conception of socialism once that said that the working class, as the creators of society, need to eventually become society itself. What does that look like in a pre-political moment like we're in right now? What does it mean to take seriously our responsibility, our duty as working class people to take care of our own, to build the sort of society that we would want to see, to build up our powers, our capacities, our abilities as individuals and as a collectivity to someday attain the ability to have a political formation of our own that pushes for our own interests, which is to say, which pushes for socialism? We're not there yet. We're not there yet. But what Trumpism poses, what tariffs poses, what the multipolar world, whatever you want to call it, what post-neoliberalism poses, is that history can move again, that things can change, that the world that we have all lived under, the burdens that we've all lived under our entire lives, even here at the center of empire, the abundance economy, you know, that we're supposed to believe that Ezra Klein is going to help us bring back, right? Those of us who have lived at the center of that, we might have something to say about the way that, you know, the world might shake out after this. This is important. And this is the project that MCU is embarking on, a sort of pre-political project. It's an education campaign that Platypus and Sublation are working on. And it's something that ILC takes very seriously in an institutional way. How do we imagine building institutions, free associations of American workers, to try to claw back, you know, some dignity of labor, sure, of course, but also to try to reimagine what it might mean to build socialism in the belly of the beast, in the heart of the empire. And that's our mission. That's our calling. So with that said, pizza's on its way. Oh, I got like scattered applause there. That was nice. Pizza! So I'd like to issue on the behalf of the ILC and myself a huge thanks to our panelists. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Cyrus. We're going to take a short break. We're going to eat some food, and then we're going to return with a town hall. I want to throw out a couple questions for all of you, because it's important to us that everybody get a chance to speak in the next session. We'll do things in the round. And you don't have to answer both of these questions, because these are big questions here. But something to think about, you know, as you get a chance to speak, unrecorded, don't worry, you're not going to be put on a podcast against your will, in the next section. So if the elevation of trade wars is truly an international strategy, how likely is this to transition to shooting wars? All right. How does this orient against other sections of international capital that have specific priorities to maintain stability of exchange? So there's a question about, you know, as we spoke about during the main panel here, like, what's the fear of war? Like, are we feeling like there's a war fever arising? Are we ourselves afraid of war? Have we, having seen what's happened in Gaza over the last 16 months or so, right? Is this tempering our politics right now? Is this something we should be worried about and thinking about when it comes to multipolarity, which is another way of saying the war of all against all? And then this is another question for the town hall. Absent a proletarian party, how can we expect an unorganized working class to respond to the conditions of tariffs, whether the uncertain form Trump has so far employed or a serious and entrenched form that has been promised? Do the potential responses by the class open up potential for political education and recruitment? What should we be doing at this particular moment? Huge question for the town hall, but we're interested in your answers. In the back, we have information about ILC. If you're not familiar with MCU or with Platypus, we have representatives here that you can speak with. This is an open invite. So pizza's coming, and enjoy the town hall coming up shortly. Thank you, everybody.
Disease that gets us by. It's a plague.